In the days when I was a member of the Church of Ireland and generally went to church to matins and evensong, at least three times in the course of worship we sang a psalm. And at the end of the psalm we sang, "Glory be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen." And I think that doxology has become something of a motto for people. They've forgotten the bit about the glory of God. The bit they have remembered is, "as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen." That has led to a number of fallacies in Christian thinking. One is the notion that the sort of thing we're doing in church today is the sort of thing that has been done down through the centuries. You could imagine St. Paul doing it. You could imagine St. Athanasius doing it. You could imagine Martin Luther doing it. But it isn't like that at all. Change is part of life. As somebody has said, only the dead don't change. They just decay. And there's a lot of truth in that. We have been changing all down through the centuries. In the book of Revelation, God says, "Behold, I am making all things new." The Gospel of Mark records the words of Jesus, who says that his Father has continued working all through the ages and is still working. We have become rather obsessed sometimes, I think, with the idea that on the seventh day God rested. I must confess I find it very hard to imagine God sitting in an armchair exhausted. He has gone on working through the centuries, through the millennia, developing his creation and making things new. And when we refuse to change, we are moving against the Almighty, who is the God of change, who is the God of development, the God of creation and recreation, the God of new creation. And that's what worries me about some parts of our church. We don't want to change. Somebody comes with a new idea, a new form of service, a new language, and we say, "Oh, we don't want that. That's not the way it was done when I was young." You have heard it, haven't you? I got a little bit of a surprise this morning. I found that the service was being led not by Carson Nicholson, but by Mark Tilley. Mark Tilley did not use the sort of language I would have used. Mark Tilley did not say the sort of things that I might have said. But I noticed the quality of what he said, the relevance of what he said, and the sincerity with which it was said, coming straight from the heart. And I thoroughly enjoyed every moment of this morning's worship. And it did something for me. And I thanked him for it afterwards. I would like to think that I wasn't the only one. And yet there will be people who say that that wasn't the way it was done when I was young. Russell Lowell, the American poet, has some marvelous lines which you will find in the old Methodist hymn book. "New occasions teach new duties. Time makes ancient good uncouth. They must upward still and onward, who would keep abreast of truth." That doesn't mean the truth is changing. The love of God, the redeeming purpose of God, the creative activity of God, the wisdom of God, and his power do not change. But you and I need to be prepared to find new ways of saying them, because language has changed. And we can no longer use the same language to say the same things because people understand them differently. Somebody said as they came into the room this evening, "It's cool in here." And I wondered, did they mean the temperature was low or that it was very attractive and charming and they wanted to be here? Cool, as the young people say. Isn't that a perfect example of the way in which language has changed? So we've got to find new ways of saying things. And I believe that one of the great challenges that is before the church is change. And where a congregation is willing to change, to accept change, there is a future. But I know of one congregation which has determinedly resisted every possible attempt at change. I give it about 10 more years of life. Does that sound shocking? But I think it's true. The old people are dying off because they are getting old, and old people do die. I was reminded of that rather forcibly by my doctor when he told me that under normal circumstances, with the problem I had a few years ago, they would simply have given me a few injections because I'd have been dead within 10 years and it wouldn't have done any damage before then. Because that was what was the average life expectancy of a person of my age. Dying is something that old people do. And I believe that congregations which have failed to change will ultimately die, as the old people die, and nobody new comes in to take their place. I've watched over my years of service what it is to work with young people. I enjoyed working with young people when I was younger. I'm not sure I want to do it now, but I want somebody to do it. And when I went to Fermanagh, I got a group of young folk together, and some not quite so young. They would all have been under 40. And said, "I want you to form a mission band, and every quarter I will plan you in one or other of the churches on the circuit, and you do your own thing." And they did. And they presented their message in drama. They presented their message in song. They presented their message in sermons, short ones, and it worked for those young people in the circuit. I thought, there's something about this. When I go to Sutton, I'll try and do the same. There I had a young lay evangelist as an assistant. I said, "Get on with doing something for the young people every month on the evening. Drama, music, you know, the way young people worship." And I was astonished. They came from Wicklow. I didn't expect anybody to come from Wicklow to worship in Clontarf. But they did. If people feel that something is being done that is meaningful to them, it's astonishing how they will travel. The cream of it was when I went to Adair, and they got one or two mums and dads and the youngsters working together once a month for a youth service in the evening. And I discovered it was one of the best attended services that we ever had, because people from other places came in too. And it wasn't a service attended only by young people. Mum was there and Dad was there. Auntie Mary was there. Uncle Joe was there. Granny and Granddad were there. And you could see that Granny and Granddad were enjoying a new form of worship because it was involving their family. And what that said to me is, here is a congregation worshiping in love. They cared. They were delighted. Now, that, I think, is the sort of thing that we need to look at again and again throughout the church. The idea of doing the right thing for the right generation. I am probably talking to the converted here. There are an awful lot of people through the country who still need to be converted. The business of change worries so many people, but we have need to recognize that everybody needs to express their worship in terms which they can understand and to which they can relate. Let me be very dangerous and talk about a neighboring church. In Dundrum, a previous minister divided his congregation into two and had an early service with drums and guitars and a later service with the organ. And some of my brother ministers were horrified. You don't divide a congregation. Can I spend a little time talking about the word divide? Because divide can mean an awful lot of things. If you have got two people in your quarterly meeting who always automatically take opposite sides in any discussion, that's the sort of division you don't want. That's faction. That's fight. And really what you want is peace and agreement and a tolerance of other opinions. But to divide a congregation into a service at 10 and a service at 11:30 is not a division in that sense. We have been dividing our churches for donkey's ages. You remember what the early Methodists did. They divided the society into classes, they divided the society into bands, and each class and each band had its own job to do. And those jobs came together to constitute the life of that Methodist society. That was division with purpose. We've been dividing worship in most of our churches for as long as I can remember. Because we all come to church on Sunday, and after the first lesson, there's a talk to the children, and then they go out. The congregation is divided. The adults remain to listen to the sermon. The children go out for a lesson. That's division. But it's division with a purpose. It's division with a reason. It's justified division. Because if you kept the children in to listen to the sermon, they'd be bored. And really, the adults don't want to go on doing what the children are doing. So you take them into different places. That is division with sense behind it. And I believe that that is one of the things that we need to look at very carefully. The division is not necessarily evil. It is evil when it is the expression of quarrel, of deep disagreement, of jealousy, of a lust for power. But it is not when it is seeking to do for particular people what is useful for them and what suits their age and what suits their taste. and what suits their culture. I haven't for a long time worshipped in Abbey Street. I am intrigued by the fact that in Abbey Street there are about, I think, 10 Irish people worshipping now out of a congregation of 50. The others are all from other countries. Europe, Africa, India, China, you name it. And they are coming together and worshipping in a form that is suitable for all of them. And what is the Dublin Central Mission has almost become the Dublin International Mission because of the people that it is touching. Now, let me look at another aspect of the future, because I think the role of the church in some places is going to have to change radically. There are serious discussions going on at the moment about the structures of the church in the Irish Midlands. And I think we're going to have to look again at how we administer our church, how we conduct our worship, and who does what. Over the years, we've become very professional. All right. There's a lot to be said for professionalism in one sense. Education is a very good thing. The more we have of it, the better. But we've got to the stage, I think, where we believe that if there isn't a minister in the pulpit, we haven't had proper worship. I mean, the minister is the one who should take the service every Sunday, isn't it? And the local preacher is just a stopgap. During my years as letter writer for the Methodist Conference, one of the lay letter writers was a lady and a local preacher. And I remember her saying with deep distress that local preachers in the Belfast district were losing their sense of vocation because they were never given an opportunity to preach. The ministers were always in the pulpit. I made it a practice throughout my ministry to ensure that every local preacher in my circuit occupied a pulpit at least once in every quarter. Because if these people have a call to preach, and if the church has recognized that call, and if they have been accredited, then the church has a duty to allow them to express that call, and not to keep them sitting in the pew, silent. And therefore, I think we have to look again at how we use our laity. I visited a dear old lady in the hills above Lisnaskee. Sweet soul. Memory was going a bit. She sat and said to me, "You know, I haven't seen a minister in this house for 20 years. She was more or less saying the church had neglected her because no minister had been in the house. I think what she really meant, "I haven't seen a minister I recognized." But that's beside the point. You see what she was saying. If the minister hasn't called, the church hasn't visited us. The church hasn't taken note of us. And that is the sort of tragedy that has arisen because we have lost our classes. The class leader was the pastoral visitor. The class leader was the one who was expected to visit every member of his or her class at least once in each quarter. And maybe they only stayed for 5 minutes. And maybe they learned more from old Mrs. Brown than they gave her. But at least there was the contact. And she knew that the church was interested in what she was doing and what her condition was and what her needs were. And I think we need to get back to those. We need to rediscover the role of the laity in the proclamation of the gospel and in the pastoral care of the people. We need to look at the old things that are going to be increasingly necessary in the future, because I believe we are coming back to the term where you will have one minister in a rural area with seven churches that he may very well, or she may very well, visit two or three times in the quarter, and the rest will be in the hands of the local preachers. And in some churches nowadays, if you have a congregation of several hundred, how does the minister get round them every year, let alone every quarter, as some people would like the minister to do? But if you have lay pastors, class leaders, visiting every quarter, because the number of class leaders is more numerous in the larger churches, it becomes possible. I think we've got to look at that again. We have, I believe, ample resources if we were prepared to use them properly and to bring everybody into the act. We have changed our administration. It was a former minister of Dundrum, Dublin South, who told me that at that time his quarterly meeting had more members than Doyle Aaron. The quarterly meeting was only supposed to govern his circuit. Doyle Aaron was supposed to govern the whole country. But the quarterly meeting was larger than Doyle Aaron. I mean, we've got away from that nonsense. We now have church councils and executives. But I wonder if we have thrown out one baby with the bathwater. In the years when I was ministering in Tipperary, I discovered several people who believed that every family in the circuit ought to be represented on the quarterly meeting, which is very simple if you have only got 50 families. But if you find yourself with 250 families, I mean, that's going to give you a whacking quarterly meeting, isn't it? But you see, that's where I think the class leader is missed. Because in a business meeting, a successful business meeting is the meeting that achieves its object in the minimum of time. So you don't expect it to go on for hours. Here is the agenda proposed, seconded, are we agreed? You have a point, yes, that point is met by this, yes, agreed, go on. That's efficiency. You can't do that in a religious body. People need to be reminded that they are important, that they are cared for, and that they are heard. Now, you can't do it in the executive. You can't do it in the council. But you can do it if you go back to the old system of dividing your church into classes. And you may want to choose a new and modern name for classes, pastoral group, if you like, where they are visited regularly. And they can say, I'm annoyed about this, I don't like that, why are they doing the other? And get a reasoned answer. And at least know that they have been heard and that somebody has thought about what they have said. And these are the ways in which I believe people can be closely bound into the fellowship. It's not simply a matter of pressing everybody to come to the prayer meeting, the Bible study group, or what have you. These personal contacts, I believe, are also important. And we are going to have to cooperate to a greater extent with other churches. That is what thrills me about some of the areas in which I have been in contact, where increasingly things are being done together. Where Catholics, Anglicans, Methodists, and occasionally Presbyterians are sharing in study without being committed to each other's creeds, if I may so put it. It is possible for people to learn together in Bible study groups, especially in these days of religious upheaval. And I think we need to have more of that. One of the problems, one of the things that has grieved me deeply over the last number of years is the way in which our initial cooperation with the Presbyterian Church has broken down. It has broken down in Waterford. It has broken down in Enniscorthy. It hasn't broken down in Limerick because of the strength of the people in the pews. It's under strain in Galway. And, of course, the cooperation has ceased between our theological colleges. We are no longer working with the Presbyterian Theological College. Northern Irish Presbyterianism has become increasingly sectarian. And my impression as I look at the Presbyterian appointments in the Republic is that the people they are sending to us in the Irish Republic as ministers are those whom they can't place in Northern Ireland. Either because they are men who are misfits, or because they are women. And the Presbyterian Church in Northern Ireland is increasingly reluctant to accept a woman in the ministry. They were the first to do it in this country, but the pendulum has swung. But what that has done is to open a new opportunity with the Church of Ireland. I sat for 14 years as co-chairman of the Joint Theological Working Party that eventually produced the covenant between our two churches. I wondered if we would ever get there, but we did. And we're beginning to see it flourish. We are coming to the point now where we are recognizing each other's ministries, and there is a joint congregation with a minister who is recognized as both Church of Ireland and Methodist minister for Monkstown in North Belfast. It's a remarkable development. And it is possible because of the social situation in Monkstown. It is a newly developing area, and all the people living there are on much the same class stratum, if you wish. Part of our difficulty here is that so much of our history has been tied up not only with religion, but with class and political divisions. I believe we are on the verge of breaking through into a better relationship in the future. And that is possibly one of the great hopes. Are you worried that the Church of Ireland might swamp us? I sometimes worry that we'll swamp the Church of Ireland. Does that sound silly? One of the deans of one of the major cathedrals in this country said to me that if you draw a line south of Dublin and Galway, Most of the members of the Church of Ireland are members of the Church of Ireland not because they believe it's theology. They don't know it's theology. They are members of the Church of Ireland because it gives them a social standing in contradistinction to the Roman Catholics. Now, you don't build a church on that. Get a few faithful Methodists in among that lot, and God alone knows what will happen, and I say that in all reverence. I don't think we are threatened by any cooperation with the Church of Ireland. They may possibly find that we are a rejuvenating influence, a refreshing influence among them. I do hope that whatever happens in the future, our emphases on the salvation open to everybody, on scriptural holiness, on continued faith, I hope that these will remain and can be shared with others. But I do hope that we will be able to make a contribution to other denominations as we cooperate with them and study with them and share our convictions with them. I've said a few minutes ago that one of the things the church needs to do is to listen, not just to talk. I think I should set an example. I think I should shut up and ask you to talk as to your hopes and your fears and your ideas as to where Methodism might be going.